to 3 p.m. at the Interstate Center in Bloomington. Expo Flair 2005 will feature entertainment and activities for seniors and their families, including wellness screenings, seminars, informative exhibits, and drawings. More information is available at www.expoflair.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the program, we'll be looking back to the presidency of Ronald Reagan and looking very specifically at some of the economic policies of the Reagan administration. We're talking this morning with John Ehrman. He is the author of a recently published book that's titled The 80s, America in the Age of Reagan. It's published by the Yale University Press and looks very specifically at the kind of effect that Ronald Reagan had on American politics. John Ehrman makes the argument that when you take a look at where most Americans fall on the political spectrum, he argues that most of them tend to cluster around the middle, and that certainly was the case when Ronald Reagan was elected first time around. And the big question that he explores in the book is, given the fact that forces operating in American politics tend to push both politics and voters toward the center, the question he asks is, how is it that Ronald Reagan managed to take this system to the right? He makes the argument, I think, that one of the things that's most important here was the economic policies of the Reagan administration, very specifically the tax policies of the administration. We'll talk about that this morning and, of course, encourage people to call in with questions and comments. John Ehrman is a foreign affairs analyst for the federal government. He was formerly a lecturer in history at George Washington University. He writes on modern American conservative politics. His previous book, which was titled The Rise of Neoconservatism, was also published by the Yale University Press. And, of course, anybody who's interested in calling in here, asking a question, making a comment is welcome to do that. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. That's what we ask, and we hope people will do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455 is that number. Dr. Ehrman, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. One of the basic sorts of things that I want to ask you here just to get us started has to do with Mr. Reagan and his style, his management style. And certainly during the time that he was president, there were some people who were critical of his management style, arguing that he was detached and he was not directly involved really closely in day-to-day policymaking. And so I guess the question, to the extent that there was something like a Reagan revolution, and I know Mr. Reagan himself was a little hesitant to even talk in those kinds of terms, to the extent that there was such a thing, was Ronald Reagan himself, personally, responsible?
He was in many ways, and then in some ways he was riding a wave of developments that had begun long before. Your question really breaks down into several, I think. The management question, and there you get not only to the day-to-day running of the government that any president has to do, but also his trying to oversee and move through his legislative agenda, especially in the early years of his presidency. Yes, he was very much involved. And I was able, when I was researching the book, to go to the Reagan Library and look at the documents and the files there. And it's remarkable how you see these long, detailed policy memorandums, many of them filled with technical points and facts. And you see his handwritten notes in the margins, and they're not always just simple check marks or OKs, but they clearly indicate that he was reading very carefully. He catches contradictions in the arguments. There are some documents where he points out mistakes that his staff had made. So it's clear that he was very much on top of the issues, and he was very engaged. The idea that he was somehow detached and out of it, that's a myth, and that's one that's, I think, easily disproven.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a Reagan revolution? Sort of. Many of the developments that we associated with the Reagan years, deregulation, lower tax rates, more hands-off government, had actually been building steam for some time. Some of them had actually started in the late 1960s. And if you go back and look, particularly starting around 1975, there's deregulation of Wall Street and the brokerage industry. It was followed very quickly by deregulation of the airline industry, which started under President Ford and really continued. The most dramatic developments were under President Carter, and then began spreading into the tax and political realms, particularly in California with Proposition 13. These are all pre-Reagan developments. So the environment for him and for the ideas that he proposed was very favorable. Now, this had been happening clearly before him. It probably would have continued under whoever won the presidency in 1980. But what Reagan did that I think was unique was try to take advantage of these developments and to try to push them along wherever he could. And you look at his tax policies, you look at his continued encouragement of deregulation, of corporate takeovers, of letting the markets do what they could. There was no real attempt to try to roll back any of the changes or to stand in the way of new ones. And I think he understood that there was a great wave of change coming, and his conservative views, as well as the results from what had already happened, suggested that these were going to be very beneficial. He understood that quite well and did what he could to encourage it.
I think if you look at American politics today, it certainly seems to be a very fierce battle of political ideologies between right and left. And while we might look back to the 80s and want to think that that was that way too, I guess one of the points that you make is that while that kind of thing might have gone on at that point, that really, and it seems particularly stark when you compare that to what's going on today, that in fact that Ronald Reagan was, while he may have been ideological, he seems to really have been perhaps much more pragmatic than he was ideological.
He was a very pragmatic politician. People forget that he had been trained, if you will, as governor of California, and he had a lot of experience from those years in tempering conservative goals with the real need to compromise from time to time. He understood that dynamic. And I think it's also true that the politics of the 1980s, which could be pretty brutal at times, still were nowhere near as bitter and divisive, particularly on a continuing basis, as they are today. You still had a generation of politicians with experience from the 1960s and 1970s who were used to looking at things in a bipartisan kind of way, who still had personal friendships that could reach across party lines to help settle things. There were many more moderates in each party than there are today. You didn't have the accumulated legacy of bitterness that you have today that comes from the late 80s, from the Clinton years, and so on. So, yes, there was a lot more compromise back then, and there was a lot more willingness to compromise. And you see that with Reagan, that he rolled back some of his own changes when he had to. He would strike a deal with Democrats and with moderates in his own party. He said very specifically on a number of occasions that he would never go down in flames. He saw no point to doing that. He was always very willing to take half a loaf if that was the best that he could do.
As I mentioned, that this book concentrates on domestic politics. It really doesn't deal with foreign affairs. And then, in fact, on the domestic side, it concentrates very closely on economic policy and, as I said, very specifically on tax policy. So there are many, many different things one could talk about if you just said you were going to talk about the presidency of Ronald Reagan. But do you feel particularly that, if you ask this question, what accounted for his electoral success, and particularly when he was re-elected, do you think that the most sort of telling thing, the thing that really helps you understand that most, is economic policy?
I think so. Look at, again, the context in which he was operating. The 1970s had been an era of substandard economic performance. Not as bad as popular mythology has it, but certainly not very good. You had fairly high unemployment. You had rising inflation throughout the decade. You had a series of recessions, including that very brutal one in Reagan's first year. But once he got past that, he delivered prosperity. and inflation fell, growth returned, employment turned upwards, people were able to go to work again. I think that's a great deal of the success, because in 1980, the main issue of the election had been economics, who had the better plans for dealing with the situation. Reagan was elected. Had his plans failed or had prosperity not returned, I think he would have been tossed out just as quickly as Jimmy Carter was. But in the event, starting after early 1982, as the recovery came in, Ronald Reagan was able to claim, and I think claim very credibly, that his policies had brought back good times. His claim is certainly as good as any other president's is when they take credit for that sort of thing. And I do think that is the explanation for most of the popularity. There was also a realization, and this is secondary, that many of the claims by his opponents that his policies in general would lead to disastrous results simply never came true. And again, if you go back and look at the claims made in 1980 during the campaign or in the early years of the Reagan administration, that supply-side economics would lead to economic disaster, his foreign affairs policies would lead to confrontation with the Russians and possibly nuclear war, all these things, it simply never happened. And there was really no reason in the minds of many people to oppose Reagan, particularly after he had delivered on his basic promise to restore good times.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, John Ehrman. He's a foreign affairs analyst for the federal government, has been a lecturer in history at George Washington University, has a PhD in American history from George Washington. He writes on modern American conservative politics. His book, the one we're talking about here this morning, is entitled The 80s, America in the Age of Reagan. Also, he's the author of a previous book entitled The Rise of Neoconservatism, both books, Public University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to stay a little bit with the atmosphere of America, what people were thinking about at the time that he was elected, Jimmy Carter certainly had his problems. Over his presidency, there had been a significant increase in inflation. Unemployment was high, interest rates were high, and he was also struggling with the Iran hostage crisis. When people, those people who did vote for Ronald Reagan in 1980, when they voted for him, what were they voting for, and to what extent were they simply saying that this was a vote of no confidence in Mr. Carter? To what extent was it that, and to what extent was it that they were responding to the kind of ideas that Ronald Reagan presented?
It's a mixture. There were certainly conservative groups in this country who were very much in favor of Reagan and supply-side policies and the alternatives that he represented. How much of the vote was that group, I don't know that you can really say for sure. I think that the majority of people who voted for Reagan, though, and it's just as important to remember, voted against Jimmy Carter, were simply looking to try something else. That Jimmy Carter, when he was elected in 1976, had decried the economic policies of Gerald Ford, and at that time inflation was running at 6-7% a year. When Jimmy Carter left office, inflation was running at around 13% a year. The idea was, it was a very simple conclusion for most people, that this guy hadn't been able to deal with the problem, so we'll just try the other guy and keep going from one alternative to the other until something works. And fortunately, as it turned out, I think, Ronald Reagan's policies were basically successful. But I don't think there was any great ideological shift in the country in 1980. I don't think there was a great blooming of support for conservative ideas. I think for most people who voted for Reagan, it was simply looking for an alternative and trying something else that, given what had just happened, might turn out better.
Well, just I think that's an important point that you make, or at least one that's worth underlying, that you're feeling that the fact that substantial numbers of people voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980 and perhaps then 4 years later, that did not necessarily mean those people had become conservative or were conservative.
Right. And if you ask people, what is a conservative, you'll get a whole variety of answers, because there's no agreed upon single definition. People who say, yes, I'm a conservative, often mean very different things. And this was even more so back in the 80s when conservatism was still a much more new phenomenon on the national scene than it is today. And back then, to have asked people if they were conservative, some of them, given Reagan's success, might have said yes, but they were probably more like Reagan backers. That said, there is a lot more conservatism and support for conservatism in the country today than there was then. And there has been a gradual shift over the past 20 to 25 years to the right in American politics. I think that's undeniable. But for most people, it's still a very squishy set of ideas. They don't really spend a lot of time thinking about where they are on the political spectrum.
You said a moment ago that you attributed his success, Mr. Reagan's success, to the fact that he delivered prosperity. And I think that critics, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from some of them this morning, would say that that was not true for everyone, that his policies tended to benefit the people on the upper end of the income spectrum. And in fact, one of the things that we see happening during the Reagan years is a growth in income inequality. That is, the spread between the people on the top and the people on the bottom widened. How do you square up those two things?
They're absolutely true. The prosperity was not equally divided among everyone. And there's no point in even pretending that it was. And there probably was greater gains at the top than there were at the bottom. That said, if you go in back and look at the figures on income inequality, you'll see that the rise, which you accurately describe, actually began around 1973. And if you look at the rate of increase of income inequality in this country, it's been fairly steady since 1973. Through the presidencies of Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, the first Bush, Clinton, and into this Bush. So to blame it on Ronald Reagan is really not accurate. It began long before him and has continued to this day. Now, the question of who benefited and who did not benefit is, of course, a very complicated one. And one of the points I make in the book is to try to break down various groups in the country and answer this question. And what I found, and I think what most studies find, is that the people who lost were basically those at the lower end of the labor skill spectrum. The less education you had, the less skills that you had, well, then the worse you were going to do. And for people who had made their living at a fairly basic level in the economy, yes, it was a very difficult time, and those jobs began to disappear permanently. Those who kept their jobs saw their wages stagnate. At the upper end, there was tremendous prosperity. But for that broad section in the middle that includes most Americans, there was actual real growth in their standards of living and in their real income. And if you also break down the major income groups, the quintiles or the quartiles, depending how you want to do it, you'll find fewer people at the bottom at the end of the 1980s, which is to say, as a percentage of the population, people with lower incomes was a smaller percentage at the end of the Reagan years than at the beginning. And the people in the middle also was a smaller percentage at the end than it was at the beginning. But the people at the top, in the top income groups, were a greater percentage of the population. So what you actually had was not the middle class being squeezed, as so many people say, and falling down the ladder, but actually, on balance, people moving up. And yes, it's important to remember that you're talking about several hundred million people, and there's a lot of churning within those numbers, so that while large numbers can be moving up, at the same time, some people can't be moving down. But again, on balance, despite the growth of income inequality, the trend was upward for most Americans.
Let me ask you one other question, and then I have a couple of callers I want to get to, and I want to promise them that I won't make them wait too much longer. But the question has to do with deficits, because I think that if some people I'm sure that different people, if you ask them what did you think was Ronald Reagan's most significant achievement, people will have different answers. But I think a lot of those people will say, well, that it was the tax cut, the biggest tax cut in American history. On the other hand, then if you ask what were some of the most significant downsides, at least, well, maybe we'll limit ourselves to economic issues, they would say it was the fact that his tax cut, coupled with very big increases in defense spending, helped to create the biggest deficit in American history, and that those huge deficits definitely are also part of the legacy of Ronald Reagan. And on the downside, what do you think about that?
It's true. The tax cuts combined with the spending increases on the military led to big deficits. It's true that neither the Reagan administration nor Congress ever summoned up the political will to do very much about it. They trimmed around the margins, but the deficits remained high. It's not true that the deficits were terribly harmful. There doesn't seem to be any particular evidence that the deficits had much effect one way or another. The best that economists are able to say is they might have shaved economic growth by a little bit, again, out on the margins. But given the strong record of growth in the 80s and the 90s, it's really hard to pin much ill effect on the deficits. So you're left with this sort of so-what feeling about it, that, yes, we all agree for one reason or another that deficits are a bad thing. It's certainly true that they became enormous during the Reagan years, but it's very difficult to say exactly what the harm was that came out of that.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's start in with someone in Eureka, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting conversation. I guess one could rehash pro and con. I guess what strikes me is of Ronald Reagan's two successful reelection bids, and I guess the question I have is, in your opinion, what strategy or tactics did Mr. Reagan and the Republicans employ that turned out positive for their side, and what mistakes do you see the Democrats made during both of those campaigns?
I take it you're speaking of 1980.
1980 and 84, I'm sorry, yes.
Mm-hmm. 1980, it was a pretty standard throw-the-bums-out kind of campaign. That Reagan was campaigning on Jimmy Carter's record, pointing out that it wasn't very good and promising that he could do better. And once most voters got a good look at him and realized that even if he was a conservative, he was not a right-wing nut like the Democrats were trying to portray him, his victory was pretty well assured. 1984, it was a fairly standard peace and prosperity campaign, pretty much like Dwight Eisenhower had run in 1956 or Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Things are going well. There's really no reason not to reelect this guy. On the Democrat side, I don't know if there's much they could have done in 1980. The record of Jimmy Carter combined with Jimmy Carter's personality made him very unattractive to voters. By 1984, the Democrats were in a different situation, but it's also one that's much more familiar to us today, which is they weren't quite sure what they wanted to say, what they stood for. They had a candidate who, if you needed somebody to fill the White House, could probably do the job, but wasn't terribly attractive to voters, and that he wasn't very charismatic. He was hard to get enthusiastic about, and was never quite sure exactly what he personally stood for. And in the face of a peace and prosperity campaign like Ronald Reagan was running, it's really hardy how Walter Mondale ever had much of a chance.
Could I try out a thesis with you?
Sure.
There's a social psychologist named Seligman, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, who did some work on optimism and pessimism. And in one of his books, I believe, Learned Optimism, he suggests that because of the Democratic failure to project an image of optimism and being sort of caught up in the pessimistic scenarios, that was one of the major reasons why they may have lost. Would you find any credence in that?
I would. One of the things that was happening in 1984, and it happened again in 1988, was the Democrats tried to convince people that they were suffering. and that the Reagan policies had made things worse. And that, first of all, gives the Democrats kind of a gloomy image, and that's very difficult to overcome. But secondly, people can just look around and make their own conclusions. And as I said before, most people were doing better by later in the 80s than they had been before. So for a campaign to try and convince them otherwise when they can see the evidence in their own lives, that's next to impossible. And there was a lot to Reagan and his optimism. I wouldn't want to overstate that case. Again, people are capable of seeing through a false optimism. But Reagan's optimism combined with his track record of actually making things better was a very powerful force in his favor.
I think Seligman does have something. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in Atlanta, Illinois, line one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Interesting conversation. I would like to ask some questions on President Reagan's long-term legacy that I find a little bit disturbing, and I'd like to see what the writer's comments are on that. Firstly, the environment, particularly with James Watt in control, it seems like with his policies we set the environment back, at least the progression of environmental practices back quite a bit in Reagan's era. And what do you how do you think that's going to pertain to his long-term legacy, particularly now that the environment with global warming and stuff is getting more and more important all the time? The next question is kind of 180 degrees away, is his influence on with labor, particularly with the traffic controllers issue. It seems like he set organized labor back, you know, maybe back farther than the environment. And how is this going to pertain to his long-term legacy? You know, beginning today, it seems like it's already having a traumatic effect, or even sooner than this, on labor. So what do you think on those two issues on as far as a long-term view?
I'll take them in order. On the environment, I'm not sure that the impact was very great one way or another over the long term. As you may recall, James Watt was forced to resign after he made some unfortunate remarks, and by the mid-80s, environmental policy had swung back to where it was basically a continuation of many of the policies during the 70s. And since then, you've had so many intervening policy ups and downs in the administrations of the first George Bush, Bill Clinton, and now the second George Bush. I'm not sure you can really point to a long-term Reagan legacy in that area. On the second part, on labor, I would disagree that he had that much of an impact also, but for a different reason. As you're probably aware, the decline of the labor movement began in the 1950s. That is, the percentage of American workers covered by unions peaked in the early 1950s and started a slow downhill drift. The rate of decline accelerated during the 80s, but probably not because of anything Reagan did. I think it was more structural change in the economy, the deregulation in particular. When Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, I think it was more of a signal on economic policy in general, and in particular on inflationary policy, that this was a government, an administration that, unlike many others, would not back down in a difficult situation, but rather would see through its policies. And I think the impact showed up much more in that realm. Otherwise, I think what happened with labor was basically, again, a continuation of what had gone before. The discussion of unions, though, again, like many other things, it's a double-edged sword. Union representation declined during the 80s. Union members took a lot of economic hits. But there are some interesting arguments out there, and I think there's something to them, that the decline of unions actually benefits some other workers. Unions historically had been a way to restrict labor opportunities in some areas, particularly for minorities and women. And with the decline of unions, it opens up more opportunities for these groups. I wouldn't want to overstate that case. I wouldn't want to say that it's to the credit or detriment of Ronald Reagan, but it's just something to keep in mind when looking at the labor situation.
Well, I'm not here to argue, and I appreciate your responses. And I guess, you know, I don't necessarily agree, obviously, but we'll have to look here in the next decade or so and just see when we look back on Reagan if what you say is the way it's going to look. So thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call.
It's a fair way of looking at it.
If this is in a sense maybe a little bit of a side issue, but it does indeed have to do with Ronald Reagan and what's happened from that day to this, and the question is, if indeed Ronald Reagan and his presidency so thoroughly changed American politics and discredited liberalism, the Democratic Party, why is it that just 4 years after he left office, Bill Clinton was elected president? How do you account for Bill Clinton?
Well, take a look at the performance of the first George Bush. Ronald Reagan was a tough act to follow, and in many ways, as a personality and also on a policy side. But George Bush Sr. inherited a situation that was becoming much more different, in part because of the successes of Ronald Reagan, and then later on had a difficult economy. And at the end of 12 years of Republican control of the White House, which is a fairly long span by modern American standards, and the economic uncertainty that plagued him during the last couple of years of his administration, it's not all that surprising that he lost to Bill Clinton, who essentially was doing what Ronald Reagan had done, projecting a very optimistic personality and promising better times. I don't think that's the best way of evaluating the long-term legacy of Reagan, because you then have to ask what happened when Bill Clinton became president, and did he roll back the changes of the Reagan years? Well, the answer is no, he didn't. He had a tax increase in the first year, but it wasn't anywhere near, it didn't bring tax rates back anywhere near where they had been pre-Reagan. It was tinkering at the margins. And in many other ways, he either left the Reagan legacy alone or expanded on it. Deregulation continued and was expanded. Welfare reform, which was something that the Republicans had been hoping for under Reagan but couldn't get, was something that came under Clinton. I see a lot more continuity with the Reagan years than I do efforts to reverse them. And George Bush's defeat in 1992, I think, is something that's just very specific to George Bush and the unfortunate set of circumstances that he was working in.
Hmm. And you think also, in part, Bill Clinton's success has also something to do with Bill Clinton, that it is a matter of, again, perhaps like Ronald Reagan, that people tended to resonate with the man personally. There was something about him, his style, how he presented himself, that grabbed people.
Undoubtedly. But, and this is a very important but, Bill Clinton was nowhere near the legacy builder that Ronald Reagan was. And what Ronald Reagan did was, here again, look back in the late 70s or even 1980, the idea that an ideological conservative could become president, could govern successfully, and bring the country around to his point of view was considered ludicrous to many. It was certainly debatable. By the end of the 80s, that was the case, and he had refocused American politics toward the right. Ask yourself this question, though, about Bill Clinton. Did he make any similar change? Did he bring American politics back toward the Democratic center? And I don't think he did. Ask yourself, what is the long-term legacy of Bill Clinton's presidency? And I'm not sure that you can point to very much, certainly nothing on the scale of Ronald Reagan's, that the Clinton presidency was very much about Clinton, and he certainly was a remarkable politician and a man who could have political success, who could create political success under the most unfavorable conditions imaginable. But I think he really did not leave very much behind him. He did not rebuild the Democratic Party. He did not rebuild liberal institutions. You can't point to a great liberal experiment under Bill Clinton that refocused policy or changed people's thinking. And I think in large part the current president, Bush, undid much of Clinton's legacy just in his first few months of office, even before September 11th.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is John Erman. He's a foreign affairs analyst for the federal government. He has been lecturer in history at George Washington University, and he writes on modern American conservative politics. He's the author of two books. One we're talking about here this morning is The 80s, America in the Age of Reagan. And before that, his book, previous book was titled The Rise of Neoconservatism. Both of them, both books are published by the Yale University Press. And questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller in line is in Champaign, and on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have read someplace that neoconservatism was a kind of philosophical outgrowth of liberalism. Is that true? And if so, how is it true? I'm going to hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Okay, thank you. Yes, it is true. Neoconservatism grew out of liberal anti-communism, which was a variety of liberalism that really became dominant among Democrats in the late 1940s. It's basically Harry Truman's liberalism, which combines a very strict anti-communism, activist foreign policy overseas, and continuation of New Deal policies at home. And by the late 70s, the so-called neoconservatives had become a minority within the Democratic Party, which had moved substantially to the left on foreign policy issues. And that's where the break really came over how to deal with the Soviet Union, detente, perceptions of the Soviet threat. And neocons believed that the Soviet Union continued to present a very dire threat to the United States and its interests and had to be confronted. There was very little support for this in the Democratic Party by that time, and so they migrated over to the Republicans, where they've been ever since. But yes, it comes out of post-war Democratic liberalism.
All right. We'll go to somebody here in Champaign County on a cell phone. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good.
Good. My question concerns revisiting the labor question about the air traffic controllers and their termination in 1981. It would seem that the Reagan administration, coming out of the election, had a mandate more or less to bring the economy into some kind of control again for the national psychology. Did their thought process concerning firing the air traffic controllers and therefore throttling the nation's air traffic for a significant time periods afterwards, did that have any, were they at risk or were they afraid of being at risk for injuring the economy in any way? And was there a greater mandate instead for their taking on and perhaps ending the Cold War? Thanks, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I don't think that there was that much concern about the economic impact of the air traffic strike. The economy by that point was already in a recession anyway. If you want to ask how much worse the recession was made by the response to the traffic controllers strike, I'm not even sure that anybody's ever done any research into that question. The air traffic system was disrupted for a few weeks, but it was up and running pretty quickly. So for most people, the effects were temporary and minor. The question of a mandate, to the extent that Reagan had one, I think it was on economics. As I said before, the issue was, could he do better than Jimmy Carter? And he had a mandate certainly to try, but there was not going to be much toleration for a failure. Had he failed, he would have been out in 4 years, too. On the Cold War end, very few people in the early 80s saw the Cold War as something that could come to an end. I think the dominant assumption for almost everyone was that it was just a fact of life and it was going to keep on going into the infinite future. The changes that started with the ascension of Mikhail Gorbachev in 1985 and that accelerated after that took most people by surprise. Perhaps you could argue that like Reagan, when he talked about the coming collapse of communism, you could argue that, yes, he saw it, but he might have also been thinking more abstractly, not trying to put any kind of timeline on it or deadline. So I don't think that most people thought. People thought in terms of a tougher policy against the Soviet Union and its expansionism, but I don't think too many people were actually thinking that it could be brought down and so quickly.
I don't know that I really want to belabor the point of the PATCO strike, but again, I guess I'm thinking about the fact that when the air traffic controllers walked off the job, this was August of 1981, asking for higher pay. One of the realities of their employment was that as federal employees, they were forbidden by law to strike. President Reagan said, well, you know, that's the law, and either you can go back to work or you can be fired. And they mostly chose to ignore the threat, and they were fired. And a lot of people generalized there and said, well, that means that Ronald Reagan and the Reagan administration was going to be anti-labor. Can you indeed, you would probably argue that you couldn't read that into that decision and that it was much more case-specific than it was some kind of general statement about the attitude toward organized labor.
Indeed. The air traffic controllers had two problems, and one, as you mentioned, was they were violating the law, and it was a very clear violation of federal law. The other problem was that they had no support, and they probably thought that once they went on strike, there would be a wave of public support for their position and to get the traffic control system operating again. But what they learned was that these guys made a very good salary. They were, on average, I believe, making about $40,000 a year, which in 1981 was a pretty good salary. And most Americans couldn't understand what it is that the problem was, why they felt they had to go on strike, particularly when you combined it with the violation of federal law. I don't think that it was a harbinger or an indicator of any anti-labor attitude or effort by the administration to go after unions. There was really no need for the administration to do that. Unions were declining on their own, and there was very little if the administration was so anti-union, there was very little that it needed to do to keep that decline going, and there was probably very little that it had to do or could do. It was a structural thing that was and still is very much beyond the reach of anything but really a drastic policy turnaround. I don't think they were so much anti-labor or anti-union as just content to let the situation go as it was going, because as far as they were concerned, it was in their favor.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. The lines are full. I know that we won't be able to get everybody, but we try and get at least a few more callers. We'll go next to Urbana, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
I'm somewhat interested in the statistics that you've been using earlier. This is sometime earlier in the program at this point. You were talking about the difference in that Democratic versus Republican, or in the examples you cited, Clinton versus all the Republican presidents over the last number of years had on income across classes and across quintiles. And I'd one observation or piece of information and one question for you. The first is that the Washington Monthly recently have done an analysis going back slightly further than yourself, going back over the last 50 years and comparing Democrats and Republicans. And they found something kind of the opposite of what you have, which is that the Democrats for the bottom 20th percentile have a higher rate of increase in income growth than they do for the other percentiles and quintiles, but and have higher income growth across the board than Republicans, up to something like the 95th percentile, but where I wanted to ask you a question was that you used something I found very strange. You said that when you look at either quintiles or at quartiles, that the number in the lower quintiles dropped in under Reagan, but in the number of people in the upper quintiles increased. But quintiles are usually measured in terms of one-fifth of the population in each quintile. So I'm wondering, are you using a non-standard definition of quintile and quartile?
That's a good question, and as it happens, I've got the tables in front of me that we're talking about. But let me answer your first question first, which is very quick, just to say that I'm not familiar with the statistics you're citing, so I can't really comment on them. As for the quintile quartile, I misstated, and what I'm looking at is income levels. That is, in constant dollars, if you look at the percentage of households making from $0 to $10,000, then $10,000 to $35,000, and then $35,000 and up. In other words, slicing the population three ways by income.
But that's a non, there are statistics can be played any way you want, but I just wanted to draw attention to the fact that usually one would look in terms of quintiles or in terms of to say we can look either in quintiles or quartiles is somewhat creative, perhaps, on your part.
Well, like I said, I'm sorry, but I misstated. But I'm looking at income levels, and the proportion of the population in the bottom income levels shrank between 1980 and 88, and the proportion in the middle income levels also shrank, and what you have is a very large growth in the proportion of the population that's in the upper income levels. So I take that as evidence of people on balance moving up.
All right, let's go to Champagne next. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just think you kind of overlooking, in as far as Carter and Reagan, the impact of what the price of oil did during Carter's administration and the effect on the economy, and what happened during Reagan's administration. When the price of oil got knocked down below $10 a barrel in 1986, that was a huge boost to the economy. So I'd like your comment on that. And I think you're, as far as the legacy of Reagan goes, maybe on a look at human rights in Central America, to balance things out.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're certainly right that the fall in the price of oil was a big boost, and it was Jimmy Carter's bad luck to be president when oil prices were going up, and it was Ronald Reagan's good luck to be president when they were coming down. I would point out, though, that the economic recovery predated the fall in oil. As you say, the oil price took that big drop in 1986, but the recovery began in 1982. So while Reagan certainly got a boost out of it, I don't think that invalidates the performance of his policies before then. On human rights in Central America, I think the administration inherited a really difficult set of problems. But I think overall their policy was the right one, and I think in the long term that it proved to be the successful one. And for all the violence and brutality that took place in Central America, the administration's goal was to reduce it by moving the government of El Salvador toward a more liberal democracy and to try and force moderation of the Sandinista government. And in the long run, and I don't think you can overlook the difficulty and the violence of the situation, but I think in the long run they were successful on both counts. And in both countries today, you have reasonably stable elected governments and certainly nowhere near the levels of violence and human rights abuses that were present 20 years ago. Hmm. I don't think anybody would claim that those countries are on the par of a developed Western country's human rights level, but they're certainly better than where the administration began in 1981.
We're almost out of time. We have about a minute left. And just because you have written about conservative politics in America, one thing I'm interested in having you talk about, and as I say, unfortunately, I can only give you about a minute, is what it means for the GOP that over time, if you look at people who have been the leaders of the party, that there has been, it seems, an increase in ideological content and commitment, and that we go from someone like Barry Goldwater to someone like Ronald Reagan, who may indeed have been ideological, but you suggest perhaps more pragmatic than ideological. But to go from figures like that to someone like, for example, Bill Frist, who is now the majority leader in the Senate and is said to be thinking about running for president. What does that mean for the GOP?
I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest. I'm a historian. I deal with the past. I'm not very good at predicting the future. Now, that cop-out aside, I would say you also should look at the other side of the coin, which is the Democrats, and where they've gone from having figures like Tip O'Neill, who could work with both parties and reach across party lines, to some of the leaders that they have today. I don't want to get into any kind of political critique of the individuals who are running things now, but I think that this polarization and ideological hardening is something that's occurred in both parties.
Hmm. Well, there we're going to have to stop. If we had more time, we could continue, but we'll simply have to leave it there. For people who are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look at the book that we've mentioned. It's titled The 80s, American in the Age of Reagan, by our guest John Ehrman. It takes a look primarily at economic policymaking and politics in the Reagan administration. The book is published by the Yale University Press. Dr. Ehrman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Programs here on AM 580 made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be looking for your questions on car care. Auto mechanic Rick Karch will be here. Also, hour number two, we'll be talking with Fergus Bordwick about his recent book. It's a history of the Underground Railroad. It's titled Bound for Canaan. That's tomorrow here on AM 580. We hope you'll stay tuned. Coming up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is out today. Sitting in for her is Tom Rogers.
Good afternoon, David. Actually, almost good afternoon. It's a couple minutes before 12 noon. And coming up on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour, we'll go back to the archives for an interview that Celeste conducted with geophysicist and adventurer Pasquale Scaturo. Last year, he began the first complete descent of the Nile, the River Nile, in Egypt. We will hear about his adventure coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. On the Chicago Board of Trade at the moment, an update for the commodities, with the exception of bean oil, the wheat contract.